This is Voices from Appalachia Radio Show, sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University. I'm Brian Staggers, and here's your host, Bianca Eisen.
From cornbread to biscuits and gravy, nothing quite says home like Appalachian cooking. But what does cooking have to do with culture? Our guest today is Fred Sossman. Fred is a senior writer and associate professor of Appalachian Studies at East Tennessee State University, and is author of Home and Away, A University Brings Food to the Table, as well as The Prophets of Ridgewood, An Appalachian Family's Life in Barbecue. Fred, welcome to the program.
To begin, I'd like to know how you became such an Appalachian foodie.
I grew up in Appalachia. I grew up in Greenville, Tennessee, which is the only Greenville in America with the extra E in it, G-R-E-N-E-V-I-L-L-E. We're very passionate about that extra E in my hometown. It's a farming community. Lots of dairy farms, lots of farms of many kinds and gardens. And I grew up around people who had a deep respect for the land, people who talked about Kennebec seed potatoes and country ham and green beans just constantly. And although I grew up in the city, I spent a lot of time out in the country with my people working in the land. So I've always had that respect for people who grow things. And when it came time to think about what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, I knew I wanted to write. I've had a media background, radio and television, and worked in university administration. But alongside that, I had a desire to write about this region. I was born in Appalachia. I've always worked in Appalachia. I was educated in Appalachia. So in looking for a way to tell the stories of the people in this region, I chose food. Largely because I grew up in a family that respected it. My maternal grandmother was a whiz in the kitchen. My grandparents on the other side, I don't think I ever ate a meal in their home. They were sharecroppers, but I don't think I ever dined in their home. On the other side, my maternal grandparents, I was eating there constantly, and my maternal grandmother would make things like stuffed peppers. And in thinking years later about those stuffed peppers, I really understood how profound they were and how significant they were, because they represent using things that she had ready access to on the farm and rarely had to go to the grocery store to buy anything to make those peppers. Her family grew the peppers. Her family raised the hogs, from which came the whole hog sausage, leftover biscuits or cornbread, corn from the garden, onions from the garden. About the only thing she would have to go to the grocery store for to make those stuffed peppers was maybe some chili powder. So I grew up at her elbow watching her do things like that. And luckily have been able to preserve several of her recipes, and we have raised bed gardens in the backyard now, and the ghost of my grandmother is present in that garden and in that kitchen as I prepare the meals that I learned from her.
So Fred, then why is it important to study cuisine? How does food relate to someone's culture?
This whole term foodways encompasses so much. I teach a course here at East Tennessee State University called The Foodways of Appalachia. And in teaching that course, I think I learn more than my students do. I think my students learn a lot, but it sure is an education for me in showing me how food and foodways permeate our existence. This is a course about not only how to cook things — we actually don't cook in class, but we share food sometimes — but it's a course about history and anthropology, philosophy, religion. So when you study food and you study food properly, you begin to learn the traditions that came together to make that particular cuisine. And we're talking today about Appalachian food. This is true of Appalachian food and Southern food, to use that general term. It's such a coming together of influences that fascinates me. African American traditions, Native American traditions, European traditions coming together on the plate or in the bowl. And when you eat the contents of that bowl or that plate, you begin to understand much better the people who contributed to it. I have a picture I took in Atlanta, Georgia, years ago. I always remember this picture because I took it the very day after the tornado hit Atlanta, and we were in the middle of that. But the picture is taken at a place called Mary Mac's Tea Room in Atlanta. And the picture shows crackling cornbread and pot liquor. And I began to think about what's in that picture. And that picture and those two things really encompass all three of those influences I mentioned, Native American, African American, and European. Because in that cornbread is an indebtedness to Native Americans through that corn. Inside that cornbread are bits of pork, the cracklings. And the pork is an inheritance of the English and the Spanish, who brought pigs into this country. The Spanish brought pigs into the Lower South in the 16th century. The English brought pigs into the Upper South in the 17th century. And then those greens, the pot liquor, if you're not familiar with what pot liquor is, and we spell it pot, L-I-K-K-E-R, not L-I-Q-U-O-R. It's pot liquor. An editor once tried to convince me to change the spelling away from L-I-K-K-E-R, and I insisted on that spelling because that means something. Pot liquor is the juice that's left in the pot after you cook what we call a mess of greens. And to whom do we owe the pleasure of eating those greens? African Americans who brought them from Africa so that we can enjoy them here in this part of the world. So in that bowl and on that plate really are three influences that make Southern food and that make Appalachian food. So I think in eating those things and learning about their history, you develop a deeper respect for the complexity of the culture and the profound nature of the culture.
You know, Fred, with all of these different cultures that have contributed to what is Appalachian cuisine, what makes it distinct and recognizable as Appalachian?
Well, true Appalachian cuisine to me is distinctive in its simplicity. In other words, allowing the natural flavor of a food to come through. Appalachian cuisine in its purest sense to me is an unadorned cuisine. We, as far as my background is concerned and the area I grew up in, we really didn't do a whole lot with herbs and seasonings. Appalachian cooks, particularly African American Appalachian cooks, can work wonders with some salt, some pepper, some oil, and some flour. I mean, browned flour is one of the best tastes imaginable to me in the universe. And we use that so much in our cooking. But I didn't grow up eating a lot of herbs. The herbs really came into our kitchen later. So I think it's a very simple cuisine. It's an unadorned cuisine. It's an honest cuisine that stays true to its connection to the earth. In something like an ear of corn, to me, always the best way to eat an ear of fresh corn is to pick it and have the water boiling before you go to the garden. Pick it, shuck it, silk it, throw it into that boiling pot of water, bring it out and add some salt and pepper, maybe pepper, maybe not even pepper, just some salt and some butter, and eat it just like that. And to me, that lets that pure natural flavor of that corn shine through. And I think that's what our cuisine here is all about. If I could take you into the mountains here and to dine in the middle of the summer, I think you would. I'm not sure how familiar you are with the cuisine of the area here where I'm speaking, but I think you'd be amazed at the simplicity of what's on that table. But simplicity means good and means pure to me. Tomatoes with nothing on them but a little sprinkling of salt. Green peppers cut up and soaked in nothing more than ice water. Green onions in that same ice water. Just pure, honest, simple food. To me, that's the food of Appalachia that I hope we stay true to. And I know people are trying to reinterpret Appalachian food, and I understand that. But I hope in reinterpreting Appalachian food, we stay true to what it actually is. Seasoned green beans with nothing more than salt and water and pork. Pinto beans cooked for hours in just water and salt and a little bit of pork. So the ability to bring out the natural flavors of those dishes to me is a hallmark of the mountain kitchen.
You've mentioned pigs and corn several times now throughout this interview already. And I've heard tell that sometimes your class Foodways of Appalachia is referred to the pigs and corn class.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up because you're exactly right. My students often call my class the pigs and corn class. And I take that as a great compliment because those two things are so symbolic of this culture. John Edgerton, who was a friend of mine, the late John Edgerton, who wrote the marvelous Bible on Southern food, call that Southern food at home on the road in history, said Southern food was born when those English pigs met Native American corn in Virginia. And of course, when you talk about corn, you have to think about the three sisters, the corn, the beans, and the squash, that the Native Americans grew together for several reasons. The corn provides sort of a natural trellis for the beans to climb on, and the beans provide nitrogen for the soil. The squash plants provide shade for the feet of the other plants. So those three things that we still rely on go back a long way in our culture. So yeah, we do talk a lot about pigs and corn, and one of the speakers in my class is a man named Alan Benton, who is, I call him a rock star in the pork world. He is symbolic to me of one of the major ingredients in Appalachian cookery, and that's thyme, T-I-M-E, thyme, not the herb, T-I-M-E, thyme. Somebody who is willing to invest the time it takes to cure, for example, country ham the old way. That takes months and months and months. His ham is not injected with brine and quick cured. It's cured for 11, 14, 16 months in a little what he calls a hole-in-the-wall business in Madisonville, Tennessee. And he learned this art of curing meat from his grandparents in Scott County, Virginia, right here in the heart of Appalachia, just across the state line from me. And Alan has gained worldwide acclaim and worldwide fame for his simple pork products. He's on menus all over the country. He's gotten all kinds of awards, but he's done that in staying true to the old ways and the simple ways. I also take my students to, on the pork theme, to one of my favorite places here in the mountains, and it's called Ridgewood Barbecue, where pork is cooked 9 hours over hickory wood. Sometimes we don't think about barbecue when we think about Appalachian food, but barbecue has been here for a long, long time. And the Ridgewood restaurant opened in 1948. There's so much that touches me at that restaurant. It was a matriarchal business. It was opened by a lady named Grace Prophet in 1948. Her husband was over in Elizabethton, Tennessee, making rayon at one of the factories. And she decided, after working in some country stores, to open up a beer joint with bar food in 1948. She wasn't serving barbecue at all. And 4 years later, Sullivan County, where the restaurant is located, went dry. So she had to figure out another way to make money to raise her two little boys. And on a trip to Daytona Beach, Florida, they had to borrow the money to get there. They noticed people barbecuing chickens over indirect heat. And that gave Grace Prophet the idea to come back to East Tennessee and start barbecuing, not chickens, but rather pork, and a specific kind of pork If you have barbecue in Memphis, for example, you are probably going to have pork shoulder and ribs. But at Ridgewood here in East Tennessee, you have fresh ham. So it's a different kind of barbecue. It's a different style of barbecue. But I mentioned Alan Benton staying true to the old ways. The Ridgewood barbecue, which is in the hands of Grace's son now and her granddaughter, has never deviated from the old way of doing barbecue. There is no gas or electricity involved in the cooking of that barbecue still today. It's done over hickory wood in a pit about 50 to 70 yards from the restaurant. My friend John Shelton Reed over in North Carolina, who wrote the big book of North Carolina barbecue, has an organization called TrueQ.org, and this organization is made up of people, or restaurant owners primarily, who refuse to yield to the pressure to use gas or electricity in their cooking. They still use wood and fire. And Larry Prophet at Ridgewood tells me that just about every week, a salesperson will drop by that restaurant and try to sell them an electric cooker, saying, oh, all you have to do is load it, press this button, go home and go to sleep and forget about it. Well, the Prophets refuse to do that. And to me, that adherence to tradition, that willingness to work night and day to provide this product for the public over all these decades, going back to 1948, is indicative of a spirit I find in a lot of people around here.
You are listening to the Voices from Appalachia radio show. Our guest today is Fred Sossman, a senior writer and associate professor of Appalachian Studies at East Tennessee State University. We're currently discussing Appalachian foodways. You've mentioned Southern food a little bit as well. Is there anything that separates Appalachian cuisine from Southern cuisine, or is there a difference?
I think the farther south you get, probably the more you're going to encounter the spices and the seasonings that I didn't grow up around so much here in Appalachia. But the cuisines change as you travel around. The barbecue changes. John Shelton Reed has a famous quote that, if you drive 100 miles, barbecue in the South is like the wine and cheeses of Europe. You drive 100 miles and the barbecue changes. And that's true. If you drive over into the Piedmont in North Carolina, Shelby, North Carolina, for example, you're not going to find the fresh ham. You'll find shoulder. But the style of barbecue is a little different. The sauce is different. Here in East Tennessee, our sauces tend to be tomato-based, sweet, and spicy. The farther east you get into North Carolina, the tomato content starts to drop off, and the vinegar content starts to increase. So the sauces become less tomato dependent and more tart, to the point where you get over into eastern North Carolina, the style is totally different. The sauce is pretty much vinegar with pepper, and there's a reason for that, which would take me a while to get into, but there's a very clear reason for that. Even slaws. You could almost do a slaw map. Here in East Tennessee, our slaws tend to be mayonnaise-based slaws. But again, take that drive over into North Carolina, into the Piedmont, and the slaws tend to be ketchup-based, with some hot sauce, with some vinegar. Go west into Fayetteville, Tennessee, and Middle Tennessee, and then farther west into Memphis, and you'll find a mustard-based slaw. So those kinds of things change. The types of greens, I mentioned greens and pot liquor. The types of greens that are cooked here in Appalachia tend to be a little bit different than what you'd encounter farther south. Farther south, collard greens are much more common. Here in my area, turnip greens and mustard greens are much more popular. So you have those variations. And another one is the use of rice in cooking. I'm a little bit of an anomaly here because I like my gravies over rice instead of over bread or potatoes, but that's kind of unusual. If you go south from here, sort of southeast into South Carolina, around Greenville and Spartanburg, you begin to cross over what I call the rice and gravy line. That particular dish is one I love, but it's not particularly relatively common in East Tennessee, Western North Carolina, or Southwest Virginia. But get into upstate South Carolina and you begin to find restaurants that are serving rice with typically some kind of brown gravy. So those little variations just fascinate me. And you know, there's a micro, back to barbecue, there's a microclimate of barbecue in North Alabama, which is in the Appalachian part of Alabama, that's characterized by a white barbecue sauce. And that's present largely through the influence of one family at Big Bob Gibson's Barbecue, which opened in 1925. Bob Gibson was a railroad man and started cooking barbecue in his backyard. And in 1925, he decides to open a restaurant. And for some reason, I don't know why, he decides to start serving a white barbecue sauce, which is quite unusual for its time. Now it's not difficult to find white barbecue sauces. These lines start getting blurred, and I've found white barbecue sauce in Manhattan, but white barbecue sauce to me speaks of North Alabama. So you have these, even with the homogeneity of food these days, you still find these little microclimates of interest that I love to study. And it's soft drinks. That's another example. In Kentucky, Ale 81 is a popular soft drink, a ginger-flavored soft drink. Here in Tennessee, we have Double Cola. So that's another thing that interests me about food studies, these little things that really define an area.
On the topic of interesting food studies, in history, many Appalachians, in addition to the pork and chicken, also relied on foraging or hunting whatever animals that they could, which has led to some interesting ingredients in traditional Appalachian cuisine, such as squirrel, possum, and I believe I even came across a few recipes to how to cook beaver tail. So putting the fact that it's illegal to serve wild game aside, what are some ways that Appalachian foodways have changed since they've moved from survival-based to a wider audience?
Well, I don't know if this addresses your question directly or not, but this is more of a change in perception than it is in what people actually are consuming. But it's fascinating to me to realize, on the one hand, that so many of these foods that we enjoy and celebrate grew out of very hard times, hard scrabble existence. But now they tend to be glorified and sometimes incorporated into the dishes that are not particularly recognizable as Appalachian food. I've watched that trend develop over several years. Let me give you an example. Well, ramps, that's the obvious one, the wild mountain leek, which at one time was a sign of shame, a mark of shame. If you ate ramps in the springtime and came to school, chances are you might get sent home because you had ramp breath. But now ramps are highly prized by white tablecloth chefs in big cities. There's another example fairly close to me. Are you familiar with red eye gravy?
It sounds familiar, but I don't think I've ever had it.
Yeah. Okay, well, let me define it briefly. Red eye gravy is about the most inexpensive gravy you could have. And it's made after you fry a hunk of pork, usually country ham. After you remove that country ham from the skillet, then a chef would say, you deglaze the pan. That's not a term I ever heard growing up. But you would pour some water in there to loosen those particles and deglaze the pan. And that's the basis of red eye gravy. Some people add a little bit of coffee to it. But it's intense. It's not a real thick gravy. And it's nothing you would eat a bowl of. It's so strong in flavor. But it intensifies that meat taste. And it's served sometimes over biscuits, sometimes over grits. So it is hard times cooking. And it was probably called red eye gravy because of the color of it. There's some stories about that too, but you've got that two-tone effect with the grease and the pork leavings. But there's a restaurant not far from here that serves as an appetizer on a French baguette, red eye gravy aioli with shavings of prosciutto and scallions on top. So this dish that was born out of poverty suddenly gets catapulted to fancy restaurant status. And to watch that develop over the years has been pretty interesting to me. But you talk about foraging. Here we are talking in late March. It's going to be morel mushroom season, and I see them coming back into popularity. People are making dry land fish around here in the springtime when they pick morel mushrooms and take them back home into the kitchen and fry them. Just wonderful things like that help define this cuisine to me and make it so fascinating. Appalachian food sometimes over the years has gotten a bad name, but to me, if you stay true to those natural flavors and respect that closeness to the land, it's absolutely marvelous. Another interesting thing, if we've got time, I might mention something else that's very popular in Appalachian kitchens that my wife does. And if you're ever interested in doing a segment on dried apple stack cake, she's your person. She is. I call her the dried apple stack cake queen. That's another example of a dish that's really honest and simple to start with, but people have felt the need to transform it. She makes her grandmother's dried apple stack cake with absolutely no spicing in it whatsoever, not even any vanilla extract. The recipe has worked for over 100 years, and magazines have tried to modify it and add things to it, but she's never done that. It's mainly things off the farm, sorghum syrup and buttermilk and sugar from the grocery store and a little flour from the grocery store and dried apples. Apples often dried in the back end of a car or on a windscreen.
Well, Fred, we have just about a minute left. So for my last question, how do you see Appalachian foodways changing in the future?
I hope Appalachian foodways, despite all this reinterpretation that's going on, takes a turn back toward its real roots. We really haven't used the terms sustainability and farm to table in Appalachia too much until just recently, but those terms have and those practices have existed in this culture for generations. Sustainability and farm to table are things that we have honored and practiced for many, many years. And it's good to see the rest of the world embracing those values.
And that brings us to the end of our interview. Fred, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. Our guest today to discuss Appalachian foodways was Fred Sossman. Fred is a senior writer and associate professor of Appalachian Studies at East Tennessee State University. He is also author of Home and Away, A University Brings Food to the Table, and Prophets of Ridgewood, An Appalachian's Family Life in Barbecue. Thank you all so much for listening, and until next time, I'm Bianca Eisen.
Voices from Appalachia Radio Show is sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University. With the following created to enhance and develop the cultural and economic life of West Virginia and the Appalachian region. Academic programs that include an Appalachian Studies minor, an interdisciplinary BA, BS undergraduate degree, and a graduate certificate and master's degree in Appalachian Studies at Shepherd University. Celtic Roots and Global Appalachia Study Abroad and Celtic Heritage Series. The Appalachian Heritage Writers in Residence and Writers Award, which support the West Virginia Center for the Books, One Book, One West Virginia, Common Read Selection. The West Virginia Fiction Competition. The Anthology of Appalachian Writers, an annual anthology featuring writing by the Heritage Writer, and poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, essays, and photography created by Appalachian writers across the region and the world. Voices from the Misty Mountains, NEH, and West Virginia Humanities Council Teacher Institutes, Shepherd Speaks StoryCorps Project, and this radio show, in cooperation with Shepherd University Public Radio Station, WSHC-FM. To learn more about our degree programs or upcoming events, visit us at our website at shepherd.edu/appalachian or at our Facebook page, Appalachian Studies program at Shepherd.